happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, aptly enough. My name is Michael Cutler. I hope you've all had a great week. I know we've had a lot of crazy weather racing across the United States. Winter, at least according to the calendar, is gone, but the crazy weather certainly isn't. It's always good to join you at the end of the week to play that game of catch-up, talk about the issues that are in the news. And as you know, my focus generally is the immigration crisis. Today it's comprehensive immigration reform, a supposed solution that really offers no solution. I think it would exacerbate things, but we'll get to that in a bit. If you're familiar with my background, you know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And after 30 years with that agency, I've come away with a rather unique, I think, understanding and perspective on the impact of immigration, the impact of the failures of our government to secure the borders, enforce the immigration laws, that at their foundation were enacted to accomplish just two goals: protect innocent lives and protect the jobs of American workers. You'd never know it, based on what we are hearing from so many politicians, the folks that want comprehensive reform, the mayors and governors and folks and governments around the country who declare their municipalities and states to be sanctuaries, places where illegal aliens need not fear law enforcement. Absolutely remarkable, absolutely astonishing. And again, my background, I think, provides me with that unique perspective. But rather than get bogged down in talking about my background, well, let me just tell you that you can go to three websites, read some of the material I've been writing, and learn a little bit more about me. First and foremost, I ask that you go to michaelcutler.net. That's one word, michaelcutler, michaelcutler.net. That's my own personal website. I also have a bunch of videos and articles of interest at talkborder.com. That's one word, talkborder. And finally, I am a senior fellow with an organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. Their terrific website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. As they like to remind me, especially when we suffer through cold winters in New York, they are located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California, on the west coast of the United States. Made a lot of good friends up there. They do hard, good work, not just for California, though, because as California goes, so does, of course, the rest of the country, especially when you look at the impact of immigration and the failures of the government to live up to its obligations of protecting American lives or protecting the jobs of American workers. I'm expecting to be joined by a guest this evening. He has not yet called in, but his name is Derek Green. He is a guy with an impressive background. He has a master's degree in theological studies from Fuller Theological Seminary, and he is currently working on his doctorate in ministry at Azusa Pacific University out on the West Coast as well. And Derek will be hopefully joining me. He is a member of this group at the National Center for Public Policy Research, and he has been examining the impact of these failures of our government to provide opportunities for all Americans, with a particular focus on America's black community. So certainly a worthwhile issue to be considering, given where we are today with everything that's happening. Forgive me, I have a frog in my throat that doesn't want to go away. You know, it's astonishing to me that we are living in an era where unemployment is a huge problem, where Americans are losing their homes to foreclosure, and where it's increasingly difficult for people to maintain their standard of living, where it's believed, I think the number is close to 17% of American workers are who are under the age of 25 are out of work, over 17%. It's breathtaking. We know how much a college education costs, and yet, surprisingly, we are importing more workers each and every day, and I'm trying to figure out why in the world we're doing this. You know, if you look at things from a reasonable perspective, you would think that it makes sense for us to look out for American workers, especially our kids, to provide the opportunities so that those who excel, those who are willing to make the effort to study and do what they need to do, are able to aspire to achieve their goals in life. That's not happening, unfortunately, and it's not happening because our government seems to be fixated on this idea of providing opportunities for foreign workers and it absolutely, utterly ignoring the plight of American workers who can't find work, can't seem to get ahead, and this at a time when we are now looking, according to comprehensive immigration reform, apparently, to provide still more opportunities for foreign workers to come to the United States, even if they're here illegally, and give them the right to work and have an equal standing in a labor market that isn't producing enough jobs for Americans. This kind of situation is reprehensible, and it's one that is impacting Americans in general, but especially having a profound impact on American minority members. I'm going to reach out to Derek and see if we can get him on the line. I will ask that you stand by just for one moment, folks. Derek will be joining us momentarily, and but again, as I was saying, what's so astonishing to me is that we're now in a situation that makes no sense. Hopefully we can get the politicians to understand what it is we expect of them, and that, folks, is actually the obligation of every single American, to get our voices heard, because right now you would never know that there's a crisis in America, in large measure brought on by the failures of this government of ours to really deal with immigration in an intelligent and fair way. Again, I remind you that the reason we have those laws is to protect the lives and jobs of Americans. Derek is now with us. Let me bring him on board. Derek Green, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well.
Thank you so much for joining me and my audience on the program. Why don't you start out by telling everybody a little bit about yourself, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay, well, I'm a member of Project 21, which is a black leadership network that's associated with the National Center for Public Policy Research. And Project 21 is basically an outfit that allows black conservatives to comment on a bunch of issues that affect America, whether it's domestic or foreign, from a conservative point of view. And that what that does is allow us to counter the monolithic, what's considered a monolithic thought in black America. And so I'm a member of that right now, and I am currently pursuing a doctorate in theology and ministry as well.
Well, and either way, we are ministering to the needs of Americans, I would guess. Wouldn't that be a fair
statement? Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it's astonishing that we've actually gotten to the point that we delineate this issue of opportunities for Americans as being either liberal or conservative. Should this really be a concern of all Americans, irrespective of political orientation?
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I mean, it was one point in time that I think that people could honestly say that, you know, regardless of what particular side of the spectrum you were on, you wanted the best for the country. You just might have had a different way of going about it.
Right.
But nowadays, I think that we've become so polarized politically that I don't think I could say that with any type of certainty anymore. And I think that we probably need to go back to just doing what's best for the country, the right way, based off of history and common sense and wisdom, versus trying to score political points and maintain power for our political party.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I could remember it. I've been around for quite some time. I can't remember a time when the political climate has been more toxic than it is today, pitting American against Americans. You either agree with me or you're the enemy. whatever happened to this idea about discourse? You know, the First Amendment not only talks about freedom of speech, freedom of press, and freedom of religion, but the right for peaceable assemblage and seek redress of grievances. Peaceable assemblage was designed so that we could have the debate and do so peacefully. You know, leave your clubs, your guns, and your knives at home and engage in a debate, which is at the foundation of the democratic process. I mean, do you find that, to your thinking, that it's really gotten a lot more toxic, that this whole debate and discourse?
Absolutely. And you know, I personally put the blame on the way that we've allowed our culture to kind of disintegrate and degrade ourselves morally, because what you have with these politicians is nothing more than a reflection of culture, because these politicians are raised within the culture that we all contribute
right.
to and are raised in ourselves. And so what you see in Washington is nothing more than a reflection of the character that they've developed up until that point. And so I think that they've taken leave, and collectively as a culture, we've taken leave of what used to be known as civility. You know, we can disagree, but without being disagreeable, and we can actually sit down, and we may not like one another's opinions, but we don't necessarily hold that against them and say that we can't be friends with them or things of that nature. And so I think that the political discourse is broken down because of the quality or lack of quality of character and leadership that we've, kind of instilled within our populace. And so, again, it's just a reflection of who they are once they get in those positions of power.
Well, it's remarkable. I think you're right. I've done a lot of TV interviews since 9/11, and it seems like most programs want to have a food fight more than a conversation, where it's almost a reality show, but there's a loss of reality to the whole situation. I think we're losing a lot out of this, aren't we?
Yes, yeah, we are, and it's interesting because it was a small window after 9/11 where, I thought that might have really shaken us to our core to kind of reassess things on a grander scale, and I think that maybe lasted 90 days, maybe 6 months, but it just, it got back to that kind of toxic atmosphere fairly quickly, and it's accelerated, and so what you see on TV, it's one of the reasons that I'm not really a big fan of the TV medium, because it doesn't allow you the kind of time to develop the proper discourse to kind of discuss ideas in a substantive way. It's just this kind of, I'm going to yell, then you yell, then we'll yell at each other, and then we'll go to commercial, and nothing is really solved.
Boy, isn't that the case? I can't tell you how many times I've been in the middle of one of those. It's an apt description. And, that's why I've decided to do this radio program, to try to have a civil conversation.
What
is that expression? I disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Well, I don't disagree with what you're saying in this case, certainly, but it's the idea that we need to learn how to have debate. My degree was in communications, arts, and sciences. I very often like to tell people I have a BA and BS, but you never know your own position better than when you have to defend it against somebody who disagrees with you. And I think it's a learning process for all involved. I think we all benefit by having an honest debate, because we're not always right. And sometimes there's a shade of gray that we miss. There are nuances that we ignore or don't pick up on. So the challenge to being effective in a debate very often causes us to have to reconsider our own positions. And you're right. It's about, we may want to get to the same destination, but we take out a map and we find different routes for getting there. Watching this administration, I'm really starting to wonder what the destination is, especially when you look at the economic plight that so many Americans are in. And I know you just did a study for Project 21, and I want to focus on that for the moment. What study did you do? Why don't you explain the study that you did and what your findings were?
Well, on a monthly basis, what I do is I contribute to Project 21, and I kind of just give a summary and reassess the economic situation and what the policies of the administration has brought us to and what the results are. And, most people know by now that the unemployment rate is still above 7%. It's 7.6%. But the calculation methods are a little off because they don't take into consideration the amount of people who are underemployed or just simply given up, looking for work. Now, if we were to take those people into consideration, the unemployment rate would be closer to 14%. So we have these policies that are advocated by the administration, and we have, let's say 14% of people who are unemployed. We have 90 million Americans that have just given up looking for work.
Say that again. What was that number that have given up looking?
We have 90 million Americans that are out
of work. 90 million. That's almost a third of the entire population of the citizens of the United States.
That's exactly right.
Do you really believe
14%
is accurate? It sounds more like you're talking about maybe 25%.
You know, I say 14% based on those calculations. I would guesstimate that it was probably around 20 to 21%. If I you know, conservative guess, I would say it's closer to that. And again, it's just you can pick. For example, we have 50 million people who are now on SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is food stamps. 50 million people, that's more than the population, I think, of Spain. So you have that many people that are on food stamps. You have, you know, the unemployment rate for teenagers, which 16 to 19, is 24%. But in the black community, it's 33%.
Wow.
You have the banks, the private lenders, of the first 2 months of this year have written off over $3 billion in defaulted loans, student loans, because college graduates are unable to find jobs to start repaying those loans. So they're not only delinquent, they're defaulted on the loans, and they're just writing them off.
And
so
what does that do
like
to their credit rating, by the way?
Oh, it ruins the credit rating, which means, of course, they're going to be charged higher interest on anything that they try to buy for here until, you know, whenever. You know, they say 7 years if it's written off, but that's a government loan. So I think I don't know if it lasts longer. I think it lasts a little longer. But then, of course, when they're writing off those loans, now guess what else happens? Now they have to raise the interest rate for the people who are still in college so they can try to recoup some of that money.
Yep.
So it's just like it's a bad cycle that's continuing to go on. And so when people say the employment numbers are going down, well, not the people, when the administration says the unemployment is going down and we're supposed to be technically in a recovery, you have to look at the details and say, well, I see you trying to spin it, but everything that I see with my own eyes tells me that we're not going in the right direction.
I would tend to agree with you. Now, I have to ask you the obvious question. You know, my area, and we talked a little bit about this before you came on the program. I always like to speak to my guests when possible so we have an idea about where we're going with the conversation. Immigration is a huge issue. You know, it impacts everything from national security and criminal justice, public safety, health care, education, certainly the economy and unemployment. And we keep on hearing this mantra, if you will, that America must import foreign workers if we're going to be successful and competitive. Why in the world would we want to be importing more workers when Americans can't find jobs? Isn't it kind of like having an airline that's way overbooked and saying the solution isn't to roll out another airplane, but the solution is to get more people to wait online to get on board a plane that can't take everybody anyway?
Exactly. See, that doesn't make much sense to me, and especially if they're going to encourage people to come here and not come here legally, but not enforce some kind of verification for employers. It's almost as if you're encouraging corporations and business to hire people illegally and pay them under the table, which automatically grows an underclass. I don't understand what the point of that is. But
well, I'll tell you why.
On a day-by-day basis.
Well, it's a good point, but you don't realize that we're also doing it with the visa process. What's happening now is we are admitting about 150,000 foreign workers authorized to work or in the pipeline to work. And what I mean by that is every month nearly 100,000 aliens, and by the way, it's not a pejorative. I know Associated Press and USA Today get all upset with the word illegal immigrant. Forget about the word alien. The word alien is not a pejorative, folks. It's a word that provides clarity to the debate that the other side doesn't want to have. The term alien, legally speaking, according to our nation's immigration laws, is defined simply as being any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. How that can be seen as a term of an insulting term is beyond me. But what's happening is we are bringing in 100,000, roughly, immigrants with green cards every month. Now, many are kids, no argument, but they're in the pipeline. So God willing, they will grow up, they will join the labor pool, and this has been going on for decades. So we have kids aging into working age situations. So we're bringing in about 100,000 of those per month. We bring in about 400,000 to 450,000 foreign students each year. We're bringing in a bunch of folks with the H-1B visas to do the high-tech work. Lots of people on the exchange program, the J-1 program, exchange visitor program, tens of thousands. So when you start adding it all up, we're importing about 150,000 workers or eligible workers every month. Last month they created 88,000 new jobs. So we're bringing in many more foreign workers than the number of jobs we're creating, and still universities are cranking out American students and lawful immigrant students with visas, with diplomas in their hand, and they're competing with foreign workers who have visas, as well as with foreign workers who either run the border or violate non-work visas like tourist visas and the visa waiver program. So we're probably adding about 200,000 workers to the labor pool every month. And this, again, is now providing unreasonable and unfair competition for American workers. How do you win with a situation like that? You're swimming upstream, but unfortunately the stream is moving a lot faster than you are.
You're right. And you know, you bring up a good point. And I was thinking about this from earlier today and taking this economic situation into consideration, is that you have a lot of people who are coming on visas and they're going to the top colleges and universities and they're majoring in, you know, the subjects that I could never be successful in, technology and things of that nature.
The STEM you program, know, science, technology, engineering, and math.
Right. And see, I was thinking about this, and I say, you know, that I understand. I think that has a correlation to the fact that we aren't educating our students, you know, domestically in those particular areas, and so we have to go out and farm out a bunch of talent. You know, and so when we talk about this type of situation, it seems like that colleges and universities and businesses encourage that type of thing because the domestic product that we're producing in terms of STEM isn't capable, is qualified, or is learned or successful as the ones that are coming in. Does that make any sense?
Well, it does, but it doesn't. I'll tell you why. In fact, my oldest boy is an engineer. He's a mechanical engineer. He's doing well, and I'm very proud of him. That was my original dream, was to be an engineer. But they've been running stories in the news. I think Greta Van Susteren is going to do a piece today about it, where we are producing engineering students domestically, but we're still hiring foreign, because foreign workers will work for lower wages. They will expect less in the way of fringe benefits, 401k programs, and so forth. Way back when, I'd been on Lou Dobbs Tonight many times when he was over at CNN. Lou ran a video, I believe it was Covert, of lawyers on stage. And, you know, whenever you get lawyers on stage and lawyers in the audience, run for your life.
Yeah, right.
You know, goodness gracious, we certainly have heard enough lawyer jokes. But here was a bunch of lawyers at a seminar teaching other lawyers how to make certain that they could get foreign workers into the United States and disqualify American workers so they could get their legal fees. Billable hours is where it's at for them. So what's happening is that rather than saying, you know, we could provide opportunities for American kids, they're saying we need to provide opportunities for foreign students. So number one, they'll go to the universities. And then number two, when they take the jobs, their expectations of remuneration will be far lower than an American. And some people say to me, well, you know, Mike, here's the deal. If we do that, then we keep inflation in check. Not really, because if Americans aren't successful in their careers, then they don't become the best they can be. Maybe they're involved with getting food stamps. They're not earning what they could do to grow the economy, so they become a burden on the economic situation of America. And very often the foreign students who come here, there's no loyalty. You know, we've talked about this as well, this idea, well, we'll give them a green card, they'll stay here. They're going to go where the job is. They see themselves as citizens of the world. How many times do you see the man in the street interview? You know, the lottery is $150 million. What do you plan to do if you win? And they interview some guy that's got a lottery ticket in his hand, and with a pretty thick accent, he says, well, if I win, I'm going back to my country. Well, where is he now?
Right.
So we don't have the loyalty to America, and there have been studies about this. I think the Heritage Foundation just did a study that said that naturalized citizens, unlike the people who came here previously, my parents' generation, that sort of thing, my mother was an immigrant, they weren't going anywhere. When my dad's parents came here, and when my mom came here shortly thereafter, we got hit by the Depression long before I was born. But nobody said, wow, it's pretty lousy here, I'm going back home. No, no, no. These folks were here forever. They were Americans. I was told my grandfather was quite a character. My middle name is named for him, William. He had been a Cossack in the Russian army, and one day he got into a fist fight with his neighbor and beat the snot out of the guy. And they said, what are you doing? He said he called me a crazy Russian. I don't mind that he calls me crazy, but damn it, I'm an American. I'm not a Russian. I naturalized. I don't think we see that loyalty anymore today, do we?
No, we don't. And that's another thing, too, is that, you know, and even the president, when he was campaigning, you know, he made a lot of mentions to being citizens of the world, And, you know, I understand that mentality, but first you're a citizen of the country. If you want to be a citizen of the world, that should give people some sort of keen insight to what kind of president he's going to be, or any leader for that matter. So, you know, I totally agree with you. I think that we've lost the old adage of borders, language, and culture that kind of solidifies a nation together and you know, unifies it against other geographical areas and other countries and other cultures and things of that nature. So I don't think that we have that anymore, and I don't know if I see anything on the horizon that's going to stem that tide to reverse it.
No, I agree. And even look at language. You know, people, I had somebody accuse me, oh, you must be nativist because you think everybody should speak English in America. And I said, look, I think people should study foreign languages. I grew up with Yiddish as a second language. My parents used it if they didn't want me to know what was going on. And there's no better incentive to learn another language than to be in that situation. But, you know, I love diversity. I'm a New Yorker. That's one of the reasons I couldn't imagine living anywhere else, because I like the fact that we can go to authentic restaurants of any food from anywhere in the world, and it's here in New York. But at the end of the day, the mortar that holds a society together isn't religion. It isn't ethnicity. It's language. If you can't speak a common language, you can't interact, you can't do business. And you see the other folks as the other folks rather than seeing each other as fellow Americans who are trying to do what's in everyone's best interest. I think that it creates a wall. And this idea about coming to America and then retaining your own language to the exclusion of English balkanizes America. Do you think I'm wrong on that one?
No, I don't. Now I would go a step further and saying, you know, coming from a culture that didn't treat you well and didn't give you the opportunities that you seek here, nobody says that you can't, you know, bring some of that culture over. But in terms of, you know, common interaction, transactions of all sorts, it should be something in common. It should be in English. And I think that there should be some sort of assimilation to American culture, and, you know, whatever that means now. You know, of course, it's different now than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but there needs to be some sort of assimilation process that incorporates the person who wants to come here, take advantage of the prosperity, of the education, of healthcare, of just living.
Hopefully freedom.
Sort of emphasis.
That seems to be evaporating, and our expectations of privacy are certainly evaporating in the name of national security.
Yeah,
but yet, you know, what's so remarkable, we're not even following the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. You know, I've been looking at this gang of eight, and I've come to call them the eight gangsters. this idea, I think the founding fathers must be spinning like pinwheels in their graves. We are a country of 300 million people. We have a democratic process that involves the three branches of government, the executive, judicial, and legislative. And you have eight senators out of 100. Forget about the House of Representatives altogether. And they have sequestered themselves, almost like the government funding, behind the closed door, so much for transparency. You have Mr. Rubio coming out and saying, well, the solution to illegal immigration is to issue lots more visas. And, you know, when I listened to that, I thought I was going to scream. That's like saying that the solution to drunk driving is to raise the acceptable blood alcohol level of motorists. So instead of 0.08, it's now 2.0. You'll have a lot of dead bodies because of drunk drivers, but legally the drivers will not have been drunk because they didn't exceed the limit that has now been changed. The idea is to enforce the law so that first and foremost we go back to why we have those laws in the first place, protect the lives and the jobs of Americans. It's astonishing to me. We're living in an era post-9/11. The 9/11 Commission warned that by providing immigration benefits, the terrorists were able to embed themselves in the jargon of the 9/11 Commission. They were able to hide in plain sight. They got documents in false names. Do you know that this program now that the Obama administration created, he said the DREAM Act didn't pass, so he was going to enact his own sort of a mini DREAM Act, a la executive order, so much for checks and balances.
Right.
He called it prosecutorial discretion. I wrote a commentary where I said it was prosecutorial deception. Do you know that they're not even doing face-to-face interviews? They are giving people identity documents purely on the basis of documents and forms that are mailed to an office, and then they send the document back to the alien in question. They can immediately use this new identity document to get Social Security cards, driver's licenses, credit cards, open bank accounts, get a library card, which means anonymous access to the internet possibly, without verifying that the name on the card is truly the name of the person who gets the card. How in the world do we have a government that has gotten so far out of control that while we've lost all these expectations of privacy and freedom, because we're in a war of terror, war on terror, but meanwhile, we have millions of foreign nationals who snuck across the border. We don't know why they're here or who they are, but we will give them identity documents without even so much as a face-to-face interview. Forget about doing any kind of a field investigation. Doesn't that keep you awake at night? It keeps me awake at night. I got to be honest with you.
Yeah, and see, and it's troubling, and I don't know how long that's been going on, or if it's gotten worse under the current administration versus
it's,
the
it's been a nightmare. You know, in 2006, the Washington Post did a story, and it was based on a GAO report. I want you folks out there to understand how deadly serious this is, and please don't think, well, I don't live in New York, I don't live in Washington, I'm not as concerned about terrorism. You know, when I testified before Congress, I made a point that no American city is safe if any American city is attacked. But understand that in 2005, according to the General Accountability Office, this was under the Bush administration, Citizenship and Immigration Services claimed to have lost, I mean, this is staggering, 111,000 immigration files relating to applications that were filed for various benefits, including 30,000 aliens who were naturalized without their files. Now,
wow.
Citizenship is the key to the kingdom. So 30,000 aliens were granted U.S. citizenship, and the adjudicator didn't even have the file. And when we hear the president and others say, well, we're going to clear up the backlog of applications, you know what it really means? They're going to rubber stamp most of them. Because,
yep.
In fact, last week I had one of my former colleagues on, Jerry Casale, who had worked at headquarters as an adjudications officer. And he told me, and I know the process, but he verified it for all of us, it takes just minutes to approve an application, days or weeks to deny, hours or days to deny one. So if you're talking about the pressure being on to clear the backlog, then the pressure is on to approve almost anything that lands on those desks. How scary is that?
Wow. Wow. So that I guess that does give more fodder to the point that if they really wanted to do something, if they really wanted to enforce the laws that are on the books, then they could do so. But it just seems that they're not even passing the buck, because that would even instill some sort of effort. They're just allowing things to just kind of be.
I think this has been used and manipulated
as an emotional issue. So again, there's really, I don't think that there's going to be any serious attempt to pass anything meaningful. It's just an emotional issue that you can manipulate people to
your
way.
But they're doing something else, too. If you look at Alan Greenspan, and folks, I haven't spoken about this, and maybe some new folks are out there, and if you've heard this again, I really want you to think about what I'm about to tell you. Alan Greenspan was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank. In 2005, he bragged when he went before the board, Federal Reserve Board, about how he was involved with creating those subprime mortgages that we now know caused everything to collapse. These were subprime for illegal aliens. We couldn't verify their identities. The FBI warned that Mexican matricula cards were not a reliable source of ID. The Treasury Department told banks, don't worry about it, you can take those cards. Well, Greenspan in 2009, April the 30th, 2009, went before Chuck Schumer's Immigration Subcommittee. And what was incredible, let me just read a couple of sentences here. he talked about a skill shortage, meaning people with either skills like blue-collar workers or high education. Our skill shortage, I trust, will ultimately be resolved through reform of our primary and secondary education systems, but at best, that will take many years. Really? Many years to reform it? Okay. And then he says, an accelerated influx of highly skilled immigrants would bridge that gap and carry with it two significant bonuses. And then he talked about how these folks would move into houses that were vacated by Americans. Yes, Americans who went bankrupt and lost their homes to foreclosure. So he wanted to do this, and he said they needed to do this because he said that house price declines are a major factor in mortgage foreclosures, and the plunge in value of the vast quantity of U.S. mortgage-backed securities has contributed substantially to the disabling of our banking system. He was the guy that did that. And then he said, this is the second bonus, and this blew my mind. The second bonus would address the increasing concentration of income in this country. Greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums of skilled over lesser skilled. Follow that. He's talking about too much money going to people with an education. And then he says, skill shortages in America exist because we are shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism. In the process, we've created a privileged elite. So those of you who have an education, or you're a tradesman, my dad was a plumber, so if you're a plumber or a carpenter, Mr. Greenspan has a new title for you. According to him, you're the privileged elite. And he said that your incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas, and that eliminating such restrictions, this is Greenspan saying it, not me, would reduce at least some of our income inequality. In other words, the goal is that no matter whether or not you're educated, nobody should make more money than anybody else. I thought that was called communism, wasn't it, Derek?
Yeah, it's funny. The more people try to engineer an equality of outcome, they just engineer more inequality. So it's stage one thinking. They're not going to think that out to the logical conclusion. And it's just like this economic thing. They're not going to think it out to the logical conclusion to say, okay, we have all these people on government entitlements, but yet the people that we are taking money from to fund it is shrinking. They haven't thought about that yet. So what they're going to have to do, and I think this ties into what you're saying, is that just like Europe, they're going to have to import more people into the country to backfill it, because we're not repopulating with children the way we should. And so I see that as a potential future for America, is this whole immigration thing. And that's going to be really bad when it comes to economics, I think.
It's going to be bad for economics. It's bad for crime. People who are hungry and don't have the wherewithal to get what they want, if there's no legitimate outlet for their desires, guess what they're going to do? You know, I've conducted investigations into criminal organizations, and a lot of these folks are not stupid to run a. And I'm not; they're not my heroes either. I don't want anyone to think that I'm, you know, saying, "Wow, is this great?" It's not great. But if you don't have a legitimate way to get out of poverty, if you're desperate enough, you will do anything. And unfortunately, all too often, anything means getting involved in crime. And I find it remarkable, and both looking at the economics and the morality of this, don't you find it astonishing that Mr. Bloomberg, or as I've come to call him, Mr. Bumberg, here in New York, is so fixated on salt and sugar in the diet, but doesn't say a word about heroin or cocaine? What do you think is more injurious to someone's health and well-being, that extra teaspoon of sugar in their coffee, or the guy that's snorting cocaine or shooting up heroin?
That's a self-evident answer, and I cease trying to understand what he's trying to do while he's still in office, because it makes no sense. It seems that they're going after, you know, sugar and fatty foods, and yet they're talking about reducing the stop and frisk, and in spite of the success that the program has had, they're more concerned with sugary drinks. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, understand that the banks make money off the drug trade. If they're moving the money, if you come to New York, I'm in a great film, folks, and if you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, we've posted a link, go to capsweb.org, or just go online, and it is called Invasion, Freedom Under Fire, Part 2. Mark Hager and the folks in North Carolina did a great job. Renee Griffith, great job putting this film together. I'm in the film. We came to New York, or they came to New York, and I took them down Roosevelt Avenue in New York City, which is really one of the main places where the drug trade flourishes. And let me tell you, you'd be amazed, but at 1 o'clock in the morning, people are waiting online in establishments that wire money out of the country. The big signs are up there, huge, 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 big yellow and black signs, 24-7. We're open 24-7. 1 o'clock in the morning, you would have thought it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon, except it was dark outside. Long lines of people, lots of traffic, foot traffic, vehicular traffic. 1 o'clock in the morning on a weekday when normally you would think people would be in bed sleeping, they're out there moving the money. And when they move the money, the banks get their share of the action. So when you're moving billions and billions of dollars, I'm starting to sound like Carl Sagan, understand that they're getting their percentage. This is blood money. This is money that is not only funding the cartels in Mexico, and we know that during the reign of Felipe Calderon, the administration, you can call it the reign with all the violence and terror, over 60,000 Mexicans were slaughtered. There were bodies hanging from bridges, beheaded bodies with spray-painted graffiti to warn people, cooperate with law enforcement, you could be hanging from the next bridge. Meanwhile, we also know Mike McCaul, who chairs the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives, has warned about the increasing interaction between drug trafficking organizations and transnational or international terrorist organizations. We know, for example, that Iran is flying their shock troops into Venezuela on weekly flights. We know there are terror training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil. So the terrorist groups are working in cahoots with the drug trafficking organization, which provides them access to our borders that Napolitano claim are secure. Go watch that film, Freedom Under Fire Part 2. They filmed the border. Wait till you see the fence. They have a section of fence that's wide open, and they leave it open for months at a time, big enough for trucks to drive through, but we have a fence on the border. I mean, it would almost be funny if it wasn't so tragic and frightening. So understand that this is money being drained out of our economy, lost to America's economy, and it's going to our enemies, the drug organizations and the terrorist organizations. And I think that what's happening is that the bankers are so happy to get their hands on the money, they don't care about the damage it's doing, because I'm sure that the people who run the banks have their bodyguards, they're well protected, and they could care less about the average person whose life is on the line every day. That's sobering, amazing. Isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
You know, where are you from originally?
Born and raised in California. First was Sacramento, California, and then I moved to a couple of places, and now I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay. Yeah, I've been to L.A. Boy, you guys have monumental it's one of the few places where I'm not envious of your commute. New York,
no.
Up, but L.A. is a nightmare.
Yeah, it is a nightmare. It's one of the most poorly constructed cities and their arteries that I've seen, you know, in my life. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, when you have a traffic tie-up, you could actually almost probably get out of your car, go have lunch, and come back, and nobody would notice.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it. When I first moved here, I first 2 weeks, I said, you know what, I'm going to have to start reshaping my life to compensate for the time that I'm going to be wasting in traffic. So by definition, I have to be more productive when I'm not in the car, because I'm going to be wasting so much time in traffic.
That's crazy. Well, you know, in New York, Mayor Bloomberg wanted to impose congestion pricing. He maintained this sanctuary policy, which adds, of course, to the congestion. This is better than Tony Soprano offering you protection. Drive into Midtown Manhattan, and I want to charge you a surplus so you could sit there and suck fumes. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Do you wonder why I've come to call the Mayor Bloomberg?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Oh, my gosh. I didn't know he was that bad, but
It gets worse. You know, he was upset that the prosecutors weren't prosecuting people who were trespassing into public housing in the Bronx, which makes sense. And he said, when people trespass, you know there's crime. then why doesn't he worry that when people trespass into America that it's a problem?
Right, exactly.
I mean, am I missing something here, Derek?
Not at all. Now, when is his term over?
I wish it was already, but November should be it. Freddy Krueger, this was the guy who said that it would be disgusting to run for a third term. And
yeah.
Then, of course, he ran for a third term. And then when he won, he said nobody else should ever do this. Don't try this at home because I'm the only Bloomberg. Wow,
right.
Thank God he's the only one. I couldn't stand another one.
Exactly. Do as I say, not as I do.
I mean, isn't that remarkable that increasingly we're seeing it, and we're seeing it in the military? There was an interesting article written by a former CIA chief about that you have so many high-ranking members of the military abusing their authority. This elitist mindset really is getting us into trouble. This idea that the law doesn't apply to me. You look at Congress. You look at a Nancy Pelosi. You know, I'm registered as a Democrat, and if I'm picking on the Democrats, it's because they deserve it. But, you know, both sides of the aisle, I've certainly gone after George W. for having Border Patrol agents prosecuted for doing their job and then sending Border
right.
Patrol agents to secure the Iraqi border. But what
right.
did you think, for example, and I'd love to know your thought on this one, when Pelosi stood in front of the cameras and said, "You will not know what's in the health care bill until after you vote for it." Was not the height of chutzpah, as we like to say in Brooklyn, the height of arrogance?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just, you know, it gives the message that, you know, we are more enlightened than you are. We know better than you. So whatever's in the bill, don't be concerned about it because we put it in there. Now, the ironic thing about that is, you know, we have to pass the bill to see what's in it. You know, I can almost guarantee that she still hasn't read the bill. You know, I think she has staffers that points it out, and I know that for a fact because after the bill was passed, you start seeing a bunch of these waivers coming out of her particular district. But, you know, it's just a height of arrogance to assume that just because you are in the halls of Congress that somehow you know better than the
rest
of America.
But let me ask you a question. The height of arrogance on her part, but she was reelected. So was that not the height of stupidity on the part of the voters?
And listen, it's all connected. How else could we elect our current president? Not once, but twice.
Yeah, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice,
right.
Shame on me.
Exactly. And so I think that with the president being elected, I mean, he wouldn't have been able to be elected, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Who knows what's going to happen in the next 10 years. But he came along at the right time, at which point he was able to take advantage of an over-emotionalized culture without the benefit of intellect and reason. So he was aided and abetted by media, you know, by people saying, oh, this is, you know, use the emotionalism of having the first black president, not taking into consideration his history, not vetting him properly both in the media and elsewhere. And so he came along at the right time. Now, some people, you know, can slide through the cracks. But after 4 years and after he has a tangible record that can't be hidden, the destruction that he's caused – both domestically and on foreign theater, for him to be reelected is frightening. That is more of a reflection on the American populace than it is on him.
You're 100% right. You know, well, you know, I do a lot of speaking events. One of the groups I work with is Alan Freed Associates in Washington. I was in front of a bunch of Air Force officers, and this one lady asked me, "How do you account for the American voter?" And I said, "Well, there's a two-word answer I can give you. And that's the Pet Rock." Think of how many people went out and bought the Pet Rock, and if that wasn't
right.
dopey enough, 2 years later or a year later, they bought the training manual for the Pet Rock.
Right.
Could you imagine the guy coming to work one day looking exhausted, and you say, "Charlie, what's wrong?" "Well, I was up all night trying to teach my Pet Rock to play dead." I mean, this
right.
is probably the guy that voted for these characters.
That's it. And again, it's just, you know, we have no one to blame but ourselves. I mean, there's no way that we can put these types of people in continually. But again, it goes back to what I said before, and that these people, for better or for worse, and many times it's worse, are merely reflections and products of the culture that we help create. So if we want to get better politicians and better people in the military and people who are going to take certain things with the type of seriousness that you know, you, I, and millions of other people, we have to be more influential in culture to kind of train these people up in the way that they should go. So when they're given the keys to leadership or the mantle of leadership or whatever the case may be, we don't have to worry as much.
And isn't that really what the leadership project that you're working with is about, to educate people, to wake them up, to take them by both shoulders and say, dummy, look at what's going on?
That's exactly it. It's to say, listen, we understand that you have a rigid ideological position, and we understand that you and the community that you're from have held that ideological position rigidly for close to 40 or 50 years. But we have to shake you and say, hope the scales will fall from your eyes, to say, let's look at what your policies that you supported over the last 5, 10, 15, 20, 40 years, let's look at the fruit that they've borne, and let's see exactly if intentions actually match the results. And if there's a disconnect, then you should reevaluate it. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to shake people and say, we understand that you're disposed to one way, but consider this. And trying to reason with them to say, this is what happens when you think it out to its logical conclusion. It matters more in the end than it does feeling good about it in the beginning. And that's what we're trying to do.
You know, I'll tell you what's been remarkable for me. You know, I just testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And we're being told that there's a be-all and end-all so that we can do comprehensive reform, which isn't comprehensive at all, other than probably like George W.'s education program, Leave No Child Behind. This would be Leave No Illegal Alien Behind. But there are so many moving parts to the immigration system that are being ignored. You have Rubio saying, let's bring in more foreign workers and so forth. I just want to credit Senator Sessions. I think he may have read through some of the questions that I answered for Senator Grassley, who I submitted in writing. But these are the questions, folks, that we should all be asking the Congress as they debate and negotiate, hopefully debate, comprehensive reform. And it's a short list of questions. It's 10 questions. So let me rattle these off just so that you can hear it. Number one, Senator Sessions, to his credit, asks, is this bill enforcement first or legalization first? Number two, what are the concrete metrics being used to measure border security? Number three, does the bill complete the border fence and secure all ports of entries? Number four, who gets amnesty and how many? You know, we're being told 12 million. Back in 86, we were told that a million, maybe a little bit more, a million and a half would be involved. We wound up with almost 4 million. If that happens now, folks, we're looking at almost 40 million. Think about that.
Mm.
Next, he says, this goes back to our conversation. How will the bill impact American workers and wages? Well, we're just talking about. And by the way, if you think there's congestion in L.A. now, imagine if millions more come and lie and claim to have been here the required period of time. Remember, no face-to-face interviews. They can't do them. Logistically, it's impossible. You may want to bring along a tent in your car the next time you're stuck in the rush hour.
Yeah.
Next, is the guest worker program truly temporary? Well, it is. Nobody lives forever. I thought you would like that.
Wow.
If I lose my sense of humor, my mind can't be far behind. Number seven, does the bill put a stop to sanctuary cities and resume cooperation with local law enforcement? God only knows. Number eight, how does the bill guarantee that the administration will not ignore future laws as it has with laws already on the books? Number nine, how does the bill ensure that federal public charge law is enforced and that illegal immigrants do not access the welfare state through the granting of green cards and citizenship? And finally, what is the long-term cost of the bill? So these are the thoughtful questions that nobody, but apparently Senator Sessions, my friend Lou Barletta, congressman from Pennsylvania, has been asking, Chuck Grassley, they are in the minority. Folks, you have an obligation. You have homework tonight. Your homework is to get in touch with your elected representatives and make sure they represent you. When we go to restaurants, we don't tell the waiter or waitress, throw some crap on the plate, we'll eat it. We're very specific about what we want to eat, the way we want it prepared. If we're not happy, we send it back. And if that doesn't work, we leave. We have to be just as specific with these elected representatives. What are your thoughts?
You know, I look at, like I said before, I look at the immigration situation, and the more that I'm hearing you talk, the more that it again, it's not just politics, but it's just kind of frightening what they're doing in terms of the security of the nation. You know, and it's just it's actually a gift from God. I think it's probably, I don't know if I'd say it a miracle, but that we haven't been hit again since 9/11, but specifically since this man has been president. Because I don't, you know, say what people have their complaints about Bush, but I don't remember him ever going up saying, I'm a citizen of the world and I'm going to have an executive order to have people come in and this is what I want. You know,
But he was Bush's guest worker program. He was a globalist. He did call the Minutemen vigilantes. We have a real problem. And you know, I was with Mike Chertoff. He was the former Secretary of Homeland Security.
Sure.
We had an interesting debate in the back of a car, and then I finally got him to admit I was right. But, you know, I told him that, you know, here was Napolitano. If you remember the incident when I called him Captain Underpants, the guy that wanted to blow up that airplane in the skies over Detroit.
Oh, yeah.
And the morning after, remember Napolitano got out there and said the system worked? And I wrote a commentary, and I told this to Chertoff, and I was there with him and Asa Hutchinson in the back of a limo. And I said, you know, guys, when Napolitano said the system worked, I wrote a commentary the next day, and I said, well, if hope is not a strategy, then dumb luck is not a success.
Right.
My gosh, you had to see the look on both of their faces. They were not happy. But look, having lived through 9/11, my attitude is I'm not giving anybody a free ride, and I'm going to let you know what I think, which seems to be a rarity these days. And, you know, the other thing you and I talked about is that we have gotten so used to having other people fight our battles. I don't like bullies. I used to get bullied as a kid. But my dad was a two-fisted kind of character. He was a construction worker, and he said to me, he said, Mike, the day will come that you're going to wake up and I won't be here. And he said, on that day, you better be able to stand on your own 2 feet and protect yourself and look out for yourself. Americans are walking away from the debates. We are being intimidated. It's got to stop. I'm not saying have a fist fight, but goodness, if someone tells you you're being a bigot because you think borders need to be secured, understand something, folks. There's nothing in the immigration law that discriminates about race, religion, or ethnicity. I could never have enforced the laws if they did that. My family was decimated during the Holocaust, and even without that experience, any decent person would not want to see discrimination being done that way, period, anyway. So understand that there's nothing in the law that discriminates. It's a falsehood. These are false arguments that are designed to intimidate and shut people up. And if we don't stand up and get our voices heard, we will be in trouble. We're in trouble now. We've got to stake out our position and have the guts as adults to stand our ground and speak up on our own behalf, because no one else is going to do it for us. We've become far too passive, far too easy to intimidate. That is not what Americans have been about traditionally. We've got to go back to where we came from as a country. People who stand for something, don't you think?
Absolutely, but the problem is it seems like those people who would normally be the people that we would look to, that would be the leaders to say that, like you said, I think they have acquiesced, and I think that a lot of people are just have thrown their hands up and said, you know, screw it, you know, nobody's listening to my voice, they're ignoring me, and it seems to me that there's a lot of apathy out there because of the direction the country's going on several different fronts. And so I think that, you know, what we should start doing is, especially at the ground level, is start to encourage people to, you know, speak the truth, but speak it firmly. And not – listen, they're going to call you a bigot, a racist, and they're not going to think good things about you anyway. So you might as well tell the truth.
Well, you know, JFK had it right. He said that you judge a man by his friends and his enemies. I'm proud of both groups of people. I believe I've earned them for the right reasons. How does that work for you, Derek?
I love it. Absolutely.
And as I say, you have to develop a little bit of a sense of humor about it, but this is serious business, folks. We're looking at the future of our country. We're looking at our own futures. We're looking at the future of our children and their children. We owe it to them. We owe it to the men and women in the armed forces, the men and women in law enforcement who put their lives on the line as a matter of routine to protect us.
That's right.
We don't get a free pass if we're not involved with those professions. We have got to stand up and be worthy of the sacrifices and the gallantry of those that we look to for protection. And the way you do that is by exercising your First Amendment right. And, you know, if you don't exercise it, God forbid, it could become a vestigial organ that goes away.
That's right.
You know, atrophy sets in, and boy, oh boy, you've got a problem. I remember speaking to people I knew, people I were close to me in my life who had been through the Holocaust. And I said, how did you allow this to happen? And they said, no one could have imagined. Everyone said, it can't get worse. But it did.
Wow.
So understand, we have an obligation to ourselves, to our children, to their children, and to those who came before us to build this great country.
That's
and
right.
It's not going to get better unless we make it get better, and that's the work all Americans can and must do. I got to tell you, it's been a quick hour. I can't believe the time is up. Certainly a pleasure having you on my show today, Derek.
Listen, the pleasure is mine. I enjoyed being here. Maybe we can do it again.
Absolutely. I'd love to have you come on. Is there a website that you'd like to talk about, get it out there so that people can know where to find the stuff you're doing, for whether it's Project 21 or whatever?
Sure. They can go to conservativeblog.org, and that's the
conservativeblog.org. Okay.
That's right. It's the blog of the National Center, and they can go to nationalcenter.org as well. That has information about the think tank, and then they can go to project21.org, and they can say specifically what Project 21 is about, the participants of Project 21, what we contribute through, whether it's legal briefs, press releases, commentaries, and things of that nature.
That's excellent. Yeah, I think this is really important, folks. You know, I think that there was an interesting article. We're going to go just slightly long, which we can. Morton Zuckerman, who is the publisher of U.S. News and World Report, made a very interesting point. Incredibly, he and many other people don't link immigration to these other issues, and they should, and we must, and we have to tell them. And by the way, you can provide feedback to the news media and tell them when you think that they're full of you-know-what. Because he was talking about how during the Depression, poverty was very visible. There were long lines of people waiting at the soup kitchens and waiting on the bread lines. There are no bread lines. There are no soup kitchens. Because now checks are being mailed out to people. Food stamps are being mailed out to people. But if they weren't getting those checks, and if they weren't getting the food stamps, they'd be starving. One in six Americans now living below what we would accept as the poverty line. So with that level of poverty, unemployment, underemployment, he made the point that poverty is as pervasive today as it was during the Depression, just not visible. So the solution is not to say, well, immigration, if that's what they're going to do, you can't fight back. You know, the biggest storm starts with the first raindrop. I remember I was flying in from North Carolina just before that terrible Hurricane Sandy struck here on the East Coast. And I was down in North Carolina because of that film. And really, you can go online. These folks aren't making money. You can see the whole 40-minute documentary online for free. It's posted. Freedom Under Fire, Part 2. Please go check it out. Watch it. If you like it, pass it along. I'm trying to start a bucket brigade of truth. But I remember we were flying in, and I was on one of the last planes to land at Kennedy Airport before they shut the airport down in advance of the storm. And we were swooping in low along the Atlantic coast in New Jersey. And the water looked as though somebody had taken a blender to it. I mean, the white caps and everything were just amazing. And I thought, boy, this is going to be one hell of a storm. And at some point, that first raindrop landed. What made the difference, and of course here it was a very terrible difference, was how many more raindrops and how hard they were driven by the wind fell. But every single raindrop begins the storm. Every single voice has to join that chorus to bring about the change we need. And that's something we have to do together. Individually, we can't do much. But realize something, folks. There are 535 people, and that's all they are. They might think they're high and mighty, they're people. And many of these folks in Congress, if they weren't in Congress, would have a tough time finding employment, other than maybe flipping hamburgers. And I don't want to knock people that do that either. So there's 535 people in those halls of Congress. There are 300 million of us. I think we got them outnumbered. It's up to us to make them understand that we have them outnumbered. What do you think, Derek?
I couldn't say it better myself, to be honest.
I mean, that's what you got to realize. Safety in numbers, strength in numbers. Educate yourself. Don't take anyone's word for anything. Don't take my word for anything. Do your homework. Be as concerned about America as you are about who might win the World Series this year. I don't think your life will change one way or the other depending on which team wins the World Series. Your life will change, however, if you don't pay attention to who's winning in Washington. We need to be winning in Washington and in city halls and state capitals clear across the country. I'm telling you, folks, we got them outnumbered. There's 300 million of us. Let's work together to make certain that we hold the elected representatives accountable and make them, in fact, represent all of us. I'll give you the last word.
Like I couldn't say it better myself. I just, like you said, these things aren't, they don't happen in vacuums. They are all interconnected with one another. And I think that, you know, as Americans who are concerned about the course of the country and where we are now and where we're going, we need to do the homework ourselves. But then once we do the homework, we have to have the courage to stand on the principles to go and speak, as many people always say, truth to power. But we have to make sure that we have the numbers so we can get the influence to make the changes that we need because, you know, it before people realize it, it will be too late.
Absolutely. Derek, I thank you so much for joining me on the program. I'll be speaking with you off the air over this weekend. But I again want to thank you for taking time out to visit with us this Friday evening, April the 12th, 2013. I thank all of you for listening. You know, I always like to end my commentaries with the simple phrase that democracy is not a spectator sport. Please go to my websites, michaelcutler.net, talkborder.com, and for my friends out in Santa Barbara, California, please visit capsweb.org. Check out what's there. If you like it, pass it along. Let's get as many of our fellow Americans involved as we possibly can, and let's make sure that we, the people, get our voices heard. Thank you so much, everybody. I wish all of you a great weekend. I look forward to joining you again next Friday, same time, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Good night, everybody. Good night, Derek.
Good night.